Welcome to Beyond the Stage for 3MBS, conversations about how music can prepare you for career success in medicine, law, business and beyond.
I started out in New York where everyone's really good. There's, you know, three or four top music schools in the city and you do have to compete for work or create your own work. I didn't want to let myself down. I felt that there was a lot of expectation to keep succeeding, you know, to keep playing music and to somehow manage to progress my career beyond where it was. As musicians, we like to think that we can work anywhere. It is odd to think sometimes that you're prevented from doing that.
Welcome to Episode 8 of Beyond the Stage podcast for 3MBS. I'm your host, Susan DeWedger, and today I'm really delighted to announce our guest is Jenica Anthony Shaw. Jenica, welcome and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Susan.
Now, Jenica, you've recently passed the bar and begun your practice as a barrister, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Can you tell us a bit about how that's come about?
Well, the barrister part is, of course, very recent. I'm a barrister of 4 weeks. Prior to that, I was working as a solicitor and then as a registrar at the Supreme Court of Victoria. And I took the bar reader exam in May. And then in sort of early July, found out that I'd got a place in the reader's course. So that's what I've been doing since. I left my job at the Supreme Court, did 8 weeks of training in the bar reader's course, and about 4 weeks ago was let loose on the public.
Watch out, here she comes. But your career in law has come off the back of a very successful career as a professional musician, and that's, you know, the theme of these podcasts is exploring the many ways you can live a musical life and the value of music training for life anywhere. So can you tell us how music has fitted into your life?
I started cello lessons when I was 4. I was one of those Suzuki children with a shirt box and a yardstick, and I used to practice on my box. Learned how to take a bow. That was the first thing I learned. It was a very attractive prospect to just bow all the time. I really got into that and eventually got myself a cello. My mum was really committed to me learning an instrument. My younger sister also did.
Is your mum a musician?
Or? No, she's an academic. It was just something that she was very committed to offering us as young children. And as it turned out, I really liked doing it. And I really enjoyed practicing and kept it up through primary school and started doing, I suppose, festivals and competitions when I was 10, 11 years old. And then through high school, ended up traveling a bit for study, doing things like Banff Centre residencies and master classes and more competitions. And it just became, well, it probably was the most important thing in my life and probably the most formative aspect of growing up. Certainly when I finished high school, it didn't really seem to be much of a decision to make. I just knew I would go on and study music and didn't make plans to do otherwise, in fact. So I did some auditions for various music schools, ended up going to McGill in Montreal and studied there for 4 years, which was just incredible. A wonderful, wonderful teacher. I studied with a man called Antonio Lisi, who was just a great teacher and a very inspirational person as far as teaching me to love practicing and teaching me to listen critically to myself. And then went on to study in New York. I did a master's at Manhattan School of Music with Alan Stepansky, who again was just one of the most inspirational people in my life and continues to be. Mm. He's still somebody that I stay in touch with and taught me a lot, not only about playing the cello, but about navigating my career and just, I think you taught me a lot about how to think about myself and what I could do as a musician, but also as a human being. Actually, he's interesting because as you and I were talking about before we started this chat on the record, Alan is someone who never got a music degree, ended up playing. He was principal in Boston for a number of years and then at the New York Phil. He was associate principal. So I'm almost certain that he studied arts at Harvard and then went on and got a job playing the cello. So for him, it's almost like the music study was peripheral to the university study, and it was something that he did regardless.
We had a really interesting conversation in episode 2 with Jeff Collinson, who held the position of principal horn with the Opera Ballet Orchestra in Sydney. And not only does he also not have a music degree, but I'm sure he said that he didn't actually finish high school.
Wow.
And we talked a lot about his commitment as an educator to developing the whole artist, not just the notes off the page, and that has played out in the career success that his students have had, not only as musicians, but in all the different areas they've chosen to go. And that seems like it might have been a similar experience for you, that you've had really outstanding pastoral care in your teaching, in your undergraduate degree and your master's degree, from musicians who weren't career track sort of professors in the university who've had a slightly different path. And maybe that's had a great influence on the fact that you've chosen to navigate from music to law and felt okay making that identity shift.
Yeah, I think, well, it certainly is an identity shift. And I think I've become more okay with it over time. It's a big decision to make. And I think certainly for myself, when I began to feel that I was ready to try something else, it was almost like a thought that I didn't want to think or talk about, because it did seem almost like I didn't want to let myself down. I felt that there was a lot of expectation to keep succeeding, to keep playing music and to somehow manage to progress my career beyond where it was. I wasn't quite sure how I was meant to do that. I was playing a lot of chamber music and I was playing in an orchestra and I was doing all the things that you're supposed to be doing. But I did feel a degree of, maybe stagnation. That's a strong word, but I did frequently question where I was going to be able to take things next.
Oh, I think that's the point you're making, is that not so much the dissatisfaction with where you were, but that looking further ahead, there was not a clear pathway for you ahead.
I think that's right, and I think many musicians, particularly in an orchestral context, feel it's very hard to be an individual. It's very hard to feel like you're making decisions for yourself, which is not the only thing you want to do as a musician, but it's good to be able to do that some of the time. Certainly to feel like you're consistently improving your art and your practice, to feel that you're developing as a musician, not merely just becoming more familiar with what you need to do from day to day, which I think also is a risk if you're doing the same thing every day. So I became increasingly curious about whether or not it was even possible for me to contemplate doing another job. Not really ceasing to be a cellist, of course, but whether or not it was possible for me to push my brain into a different space and to make new pathways, I suppose, and just challenge myself intellectually a little bit more.
I think it's the dual pathway of looking for the academic challenge and longing for that growth, but also the frightening prospect of, well, who am I if I'm not a cellist?
Certainly that. It's, and, Susan, the other thing, which I think not many people talk about, I'm happy to talk about it, is really that feeling that you're going to be judged by your fellow musicians for leaving.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, something that we shouldn't ignore. There's a real... there's a real fear.
It's a stigma too.
It is. And because what we do is overwhelmingly about external validation, that choosing to step away from that for whatever reason is really scary. Exciting, certainly, but we're programmed a particular way after a while when you start, when you've started at age 4 and you either do well or you don't do well enough.
And that's the way we're trained by our teachers as well. Right. We expect our teacher to give us the go ahead to say, yes, you're ready to sing that aria or you're ready to take this challenge. And so we are hardwired from age 4 for someone else's approval on work yes, in progress. Yeah.
Certainly.
Yeah. I'm really interested to dig a little bit further into exactly how that happened. But if we can go back a little bit chronologically. Yes. So you finished
of course,
in New York, and obviously Melbourne's a long way from New York. So what happened after you finished your master's at MSM?
Well, while I was studying, I met my now husband, Matt, who had the same cello teacher as me and who was a few years ahead of me. He'd finished his master's and was living and working in New York as a cellist as well. And so we met there, and eventually Matt went back to Australia and was living in Sydney doing a lot of casual work for SSO and then auditioning around the circuit that you do, you know, and he was doing all the big orchestral auditions in the region and won himself a job in Perth at West Australian Symphony. And so I stayed in New York for a little while longer and then eventually got very lonely and bored. And I'd finished my degree and I missed my boyfriend. So I am,
and the sun shines in Perth.
Well, that's true. Although, you know, I didn't really have much to go on. You know, I'd never been to Perth and I didn't know anything about it. I got on a plane and traveled from New York to Perth, initially on a working holiday visa, just to sort of see what was out there, and continued to take work back in the States and Canada as well. And I took another tour as well. Mm-hmm. And Perth is, as it turns out, a very difficult place to commute from for work. I was spending as much money and time getting to the festivals and the concerts that I wanted to play in as I was, you know, actually earning and exposing myself doing it. You know, so that eventually I realized that that was kind of an untenable option. So I still, you know, did go back for the odd summer festival, but I stopped trying to split my career between Australia and the States.
Just to interrupt just for a second for our listeners, they may know Matt, your husband. Matt Hoy is the program director at ANAM.
Yes, that's right.
A very well-respected cellist and a very well-respected music leader in our country. So they may have heard Matt play. And the other thing is, I guess you having moved on the visa you were on to Perth, our listeners may not know that when Australian orchestras have cello positions available, that overseas applicants are not able to apply for those until there's been two domestic rounds of auditions and they've been unable to award a trial and an offer of a contract. So you were in Perth unable to apply for any jobs that might have been coming up in the orchestras in Australia during that period as well.
That's a really good point, Susan, and certainly something that I didn't appreciate at the time when I was coming over here. I got a fair amount of contract work, which was great. But as you say, I wasn't doing the audition circuit as much as one would have expected, and therefore wasn't practicing my audition skills as much as I would have otherwise. Now, eventually, I was able to get a different visa. It took a few years, and then I did start doing first round auditions, as they call them. Mm. But yes, that's true, and that is definitely something that I think isn't always apparent on its face. As musicians, we like to think that we can work anywhere.
That's a translatable skill.
Well, if you're the best one on the day, or you happen to have a relationship with some of the other people who are putting on a concert or a festival, or you know, there's a number of ways in which you can secure work, and it is odd to think sometimes that you're prevented from doing that by laws and regulations.
It's quite ironic now, isn't it? From a barrister.
Yeah, although I'm not an employment law barrister, so that's all right.
So during this period that you were in Perth, you were completely freelancing and taking work everywhere, all over the world, by the sound of it.
I suppose I was doing, you know, sort of 8-week contracts. You know, if I got an 8-week contract in an orchestra, that was great, because that was a, you know, that was a wage, I suppose, for that period of time. I was doing a little bit of teaching, did some teaching at UWA, and yeah, absolutely, was essentially going wherever I could go to get work.
And were you starting to think about creating work for yourself at that point? Because obviously there was a restriction on avenues to working full time with orchestras. Mm.
Yeah, look, that was always something that formed a part of my own career. I mean, particularly because I started out in New York, where everyone's really good. There's, you know, three or four top music schools in the city, and you do have to compete for work or create your own work.
Mm.
And so I did, at that early stage, become very interested in things like starting groups and playing new composers' works, aligning yourself with either a group of composers or a group of dancers or filmmakers or people who are generating sort of, I suppose, complementary art,
mm.
and looking for ways to participate in that way.
Mm.
That's always been interesting to me.
And they have a great center at Manhattan School of Music, the Center for Creative Leadership, Center for Music Leadership. So they have a culture within that school of supporting outcomes beyond the orchestral chair. Yeah, so it's
that's true.
Yeah, so it's, I think it's embedded in the culture of the school that there will be a requirement for you to create opportunity for yourself and not to be a passenger in your career. And that hopefully would have stood you in good stead had you continued to pursue that, that you had the mindset of willingness to take on creating that opportunity for yourself.
Yeah, that's probably true. I think what it ultimately comes down to, I think, for many musicians is actually just the bare bones of needing to earn money
mm.
and wanting to do that playing your instrument rather than waiting tables or working in a bookshop or, you know, I mean, all of those things are really fun and I have done all of those things. But ultimately, if you're playing and you're exercising your fingers and your brain and your ears, you know, I would always consider that to be an optimal way to earn money, even if it was the type of gig that might be a bit fringy or wasn't likely to lead to anything further.
Mm.
But, you know, those music schools as well do have a real embedded tradition of that sort of old school trajectory
mm.
of practicing in your room by yourself, winning an audition, and then see ya.
Mm.
Hello, success, and off you go.
Mm.
I mean, I know that Matt did his master's degree in a different program than I did, and he did his master's degree actually in orchestral performance, which meant that his music education at the master's level was almost exclusively geared at audition technique,
mm.
Orchestral repertoire.
Repertoire knowledge, yeah.
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 But that said, he very successfully won himself an orchestral mm. job.
And that's great that there's the avenue to tailor that at mm. that level. Yeah. I don't believe in this country there's that opportunity to tailor the master's program to chamber or orchestral or musicology.
Yes.
It's just still the masters of music.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
But in a way, that gives you the opportunity, you know, as you've discovered through what you've been doing, to introduce these other aspects and not have them be seen as distractions from the practicing
mm.
and lessons aspect of the master's mm. degree, which I think certainly was alive as a concern when I was studying, that, you know, anything that you did outside of
the practice room.
Yeah, the practice room was perhaps maybe not the best use of your time.
Yeah.
And I certainly know that now to not be the case, but it is certainly a compelling narrative when you're trying to get your time in and there's nine other cellists and everybody's got to be the best.
And I think that's partly because of the faculty that we have within the music schools are the very tiny, tiny percentage who've won the job in the orchestra or they've won the teaching job.
That's
so there's
right.
there's little diversity in the backgrounds unless you look at your teacher at MSM
mm.
who didn't happen to have done that. But generally speaking, that's been the career trajectory that they've pursued and been the small
yeah,
percentage.
That's right.
And so there's not an understanding for them of other avenues that could be explored or the need for looking at a wider skill set to complement the artistic excellence.
I think that's right. And the mm. world's, you know, the world's changed. It
hasn't
changed. Been that, you know, I don't pretend to think that I have been, you know, out of music school for that long, but it has really changed. Mm. There, you know, orchestras are folding all over the place. And even if you do win a job, it's, you know, you're not looking at a great wage. It can be a very demanding environment. It can offer very few opportunities to diversify. And I think if you've had a really eclectic and interesting music education upbringing, it can feel quite confined.
Mm. That's why I'd say to young people that I don't think there's ever been a better time than now to forge a career as an artist, because the gatekeepers are gone. There's nobody between us and our audience. And also the ability to create employment for ourselves through our music. Orchestras are not the only avenue to separate people from their money for your art. And I don't think there's ever been a better time to be forging a career as an independent voice and finding an audience that has a need that isn't being met.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of people who love classical music but for whom the standard concert experience is quite off-putting for them, or it's out of their reach financially. And how do we go about servicing that group of people?
Yeah.
And that's where the future can lay for us if we're willing to look at an expanded range of where we could go with our art, not just the concert platform.
And I think young musicians need to be supported to make that decision. Mm. It can't feel like a cop-out.
And they need to, I think we were talking about this before, about how around your transition, how you were concerned about letting yourself down, and I'm guessing by extension letting the teachers who've invested in you.
Sure, and my down. And, you know, and my family, and you know, the other people that I teach with and play for, and all the rest.
So of the more conversations we have around owning what success means for you as a musician, and if that means doing something other than playing on stage and having a creative life in another way, that's still a really great outcome for you. And so the more conversations like this we can have for our young people, they'll be able to have an expanded zoom open the camera lens of all the places that a music training could take them once they're clear on what it is they want to do.
Absolutely. And I think that dialogue with myself at that time was ultimately very unhelpful. Certainly it was born from, you know, a degree of trepidation. And of course, those messages that you grow up with about, you know, what it means to be successful.
Yeah.
But looking back on it now, I can see that I wasted a lot of energy being fearful about being judged in that way. And I think actually it was a great decision. I feel really pleased about the way that things have turned out. And I feel really good about being able to try something new.
So how did the decision-making process play out for you from a busy but challenging freelance life?
Yeah, look, I just eventually realized that I was doing the same thing over and over and over again and nothing was changing. You know that expression they say, you know, it's the definition of insanity is repeating the same action over and over again and hoping for a different outcome.
Mm.
Which is not to say that I was, you know, unhappy doing that same thing, but I was, you know, in my sort of mid-late 20s, and I didn't want to just be picking up the little bit of work that I could do and the teaching and just always wondering. And I also just got tired of flogging myself at orchestral auditions. You know, I had a lot of real pleasure from playing in orchestras. This is certainly not meant to be disparaging of orchestras in any way. The most satisfying musical experiences I can remember have been in the middle of this wonderful sound and playing with a whole bunch of people. But you come runner up four or five times in a row in auditions, and it just starts to feel really it's exhausting.
Mm.
I mean, you know what it's like. There's a good 12 weeks of dedicated preparation that you really aren't doing anything else.
It eats all of your life. Yeah.
And all the nerves and the self-talk that goes with it. And you can play absolutely wonderfully, and it just might not be your day.
Mm. It's like elite sports.
Yes.
It's win or fail. They're the only outcomes. But
that's right.
But we're not trained in our education. That's not discussed. We only see the winners, and we don't talk about the emotional and psychological resilience that's required to get through the years of it being not you yet, which it is.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Mm.
And you know, certainly not winning an audition wasn't and isn't an impediment to having lots of work playing in orchestras, if that's what you want to do.
But it's, what do I do with these feelings that I have? What does it mean?
That's right. Yeah. And there's the security too. You know, you think, how am I going to know that I'm going to have work this time next year?
Yeah.
Or how do I know that I should say yes to this one thing that doesn't pay very well when I might get something else? But it's just a constant uncertainty. Mm. Funnily enough, now I'm a barrister and that's exactly what I have to do.
Well, you've got to think about it this way. You're trained to navigate that really well. You've got loads of experience.
This is one of the transferable skills that we can talk about.
So how did you decide on law, Jenica?
Well, that's an interesting question, Susan. I didn't particularly decide on law straight away. I was very curious about going back to university because I think, like a lot of people, I associated study with a really exciting time in my life and learning more and, just finding out more about myself and feeling that real flow of energy that comes from challenging yourself. And I think ultimately that's what I was missing the most and what I was seeking. So I thought, I want to do some study, which is a very broad place to start.
You open up the handbook. That's right. There's no subject called study.
Just to learn some stuff, extra stuff. Look, but I had actually initially considered doing a master's in psychology with the idea that I would explore performance preparation and nerves and ways to practice your instrument or ways to prepare yourself for various situations that would allow people to perform more confidently or to face particular challenges that they were having. And the real deciding factor was when I looked at that, and I wanted to stay in Australia to do that because I was, already living here and at that stage married to my husband, is that it was going to take me a 4 years to do an honours science degree undergrad, and then I'd have to do this master's on top of it, and then I could start thinking about maybe looking for trainee positions. And I just thought to myself, that's going to take too long. I'm really interested in this, but I don't have that kind of time, and frankly, I don't have that kind of money to invest in that amount of full-time study. And so I began to think a little bit more laterally about the types of transferable skills that I had.
Mm.
And that's really when I started thinking, what am I good at doing? What can I do that I can do in another environment and use the same skills? So I thought, okay, well, I can concentrate pretty well. If I need to, I can go into a room by myself and come out with something a few days later that I'm not, ashamed to present. And I thought, well, I'm a fairly critical thinker. I've always been very curious about, other people's lives and why things are the way they are and world politics and all the rest of it. And I am, I suppose, a self-avowed skeptic. I love a conspiracy theory. So I started thinking, and I really like to read. And, maybe this is, anytime we were doing stuff, we used to have this group called Wood, and we would do touring and a bit of recording. And anytime we had, APRA agreements or contracts, I was always very interested in reading them.
Mm.
And I thought, I'm not finding this boring at all. So I thought, maybe I'll try law. And funnily enough, Matt, when I told him about this, looked at me and said, are you sure that's an aspect of your personality you want to develop? I think he was a little worried. I love an argument. And so what I had to do in order to do graduate law was take the standardized test called the LSAT. So I thought, well, I'll study for the test, and if I enjoy studying for the test, then I'll do the test. And as it turns out, studying for that test is really fun. There are all these logic games and reading comprehension questions and problem-solving stuff like, putting the right number of giraffes into the cage. And it was great. That was really fun. So I enjoyed that and took the LSAT. And then I thought to myself, well, if I get an okay score, I'll apply to law school. So I got my score back and I thought, I can apply to law school with this. And then we had to decide what we were going to do about law school. And I thought, I'm only going to do this once.
Mm.
I'm going to think carefully about where I'd like to be. And so only applied to Melbourne Law School. Because I thought, well, we're making a change here. We're making a big change. And Matt was ready for a change at that stage as well. And we just thought, why not? This is an opportunity to try that. And as it turns out, I got a spot at Melbourne Law School. And they were happy to give me a little bit of money as well, which was really helpful. And that helped me make that decision. Mm. So I just jumped right in. And after the first week, I could, you know, I felt good. You know, it felt like this is something that I actually really enjoy doing. And I was surrounded by people who were very curious and who were very clever and who had really interesting perspectives on the world and clearly knew a lot about their respective fields, you know, because I was in this graduate program. Everyone had come from perhaps not the sort of background that I did, but at least had done previous study. And it was just, yeah, it was a really nurturing environment there. I really liked it. And of course, I was a bit of an oddball coming from where I'd come from. You know, you go around the class and everybody says what they were doing before. And it was always a bit strange, you know, when you say that you're a cellist, the conversation stops a bit and they think, well, what are you doing here? How are you going to be doing this? But it, you know, law school was a lot like music school.
Which is where you had flourished and felt very much at home.
Well, I know. And even though it was challenging and very competitive at times, you learn what you need to do. And so it didn't feel like a foreign environment. Mm. You know, this notion of having deadlines or assignments or other students around you who might feel a bit competitive, none of that was terribly new to me.
Yes, and so or confronting either.
Yeah. Mm. And you can sort of work, you know, you position yourself in there and you think about reasons that you're doing what you're doing, and you pursue your own interests and you do your best work if you need to. And I found it a really, really comfortable place, actually.
Found your tribe.
Yeah, I really liked it. And so it made me feel much increasingly more confident about my decision. Then when I graduated with the JD, I got an associateship at the Court of Appeal, Supreme Court, which was a wonderful transition because it was sort of from this rarefied study environment of the law school to the kind of rarefied intellectual rigor of the Court of Appeal as well. So that was a very easy transition. And then I moved down to be an associate to a judge of the trial division, and that was very different, much busier and lots of fact-finding and admin. Fascinating. And, of course, the opportunity to watch trials and to participate in that trial advocacy and litigation. And it was fascinating for me. I really liked it.
You were talking a little bit before about some of the transitional skills that you feel worked, mapped really well for you around, you know, analysis and logic and concentration. But it seems to me actually an overarching theme for you, Jenica, is the bravery to take a leap of faith, because you've taken some really major jumps from one place to another. You went from McGill in Canada down to New York to study, and then headed from New York to almost the other side of the world to Perth.
Yes.
And then back to Melbourne and jumped across to law, in the middle of that trying to look at whether psychology would be a good fit for you. And I think this training that we have when the door between backstage and the concert platform opens and we have to step out and be seen and commit to delivering, and that the vulnerability and the bravery to take that step out on the concert platform, that that's possibly helped you to be able to make some of these really brave choices and big transitions through your life.
Yes, how interesting. Yes, I think you're probably right, Susan. And certainly I think for many musicians, big transitions are par for the course, because you have to keep moving in order to keep up what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know many arts undergrads who will necessarily, as a matter of course, see it to be necessary to go overseas to do a master's. But it's probably, I would say, 80% of music graduates, if they want to do further study, would probably need to leave their country, whatever it was, and go somewhere else, or at least leave the state and move somewhere new. And it's just something that comes with the career choice.
And it also comes with our training in this freelance economy.
That's right. And you have to go where the work
is.
Yeah,
so that training for you as a freelance musician was probably a really good step, really good set to cope with the challenges of a career as a barrister.
Hopefully it will, yeah. Mm. And I think, you know, you're talking about these various traits or these various qualities that have informed my you know, my approach to music and performance, but also my approach to legal analysis and advocacy. But I've written some of these things down, and I was thinking on the way over here about ways in which we have really similar approaches to, for example, interpretation of text or of music. That's something that's incredibly important for a musician. You don't have to play something the same as anyone else, you know? Look at the Bach suites. I mean, how many times have we heard different artists interpret those? They never sound the same. They're incredibly rich and these beautiful sources of inspiration and interpretation.
And being confident in taking your interpretation to that, into an audience, which that's you do it. In the courtroom or on the in the concert hall.
And that you can change your mind and you can do it once one way and another time a different way. That you're not wedded to a particular way of doing it over and over and over again.
Cognitive flexibility is really major.
That's a very good way of putting it. Cognitive flexibility. And the other thing that I was thinking was a really important skill that a lot of musicians, I think, learn by osmosis is critical thinking.
Yeah.
You know, you're taught from the very start to analyze what you're doing and to work out whether or not you agree with it. Critical thinking can also be applied, you know, when you're practicing, you're listening to yourself, you're thinking, am I satisfied with that?
Mm.
You might be, or you might not be. But just that ability to keep an eye on your own performance and to keep an eye on external factors, I think is incredibly useful.
Mm.
And that sort of self...
Self-assessment,
and also just that ability to sort of keep monitoring yourself.
Mm.
How am I feeling right now? How is this going for me? Do I need to change my approach? Do I need to, you know, in this sense of a cello performance, I would often think to myself, you know, do I need to take a breath? You know, do I need to loosen my bow grip?
Mm.
Do I need to sit up a bit straighter? Is my end pin the right height? All of these things that you can make, these little variable adjustments to improve your performance, I think are really useful things when you're doing a job other than music.
Absolutely. So, Jenny, can you tell us what role music plays in your life now?
Well, I do not practice the cello as much as I should. It is shocking. And I'm admitting this now in public.
It's out.
I'm going to hopefully shame my own self into practicing more often. I do get the cello out. My son, who's 5, has a little cello, and he's learning the cello now. So we will often get our instruments out as a family, which is quite interesting. It's completely normal for him. Obviously, everyone has a cello. That's just what you do.
Well, mum and dad have a cello.
Yeah, everyone in the family's got a cello. So I do play with him. I really enjoy going to concerts. I think I enjoy going to concerts more now than I did when I was playing for a living. I remember the first time I was still studying at Melbourne Uni and my mum came out to visit, and we went to a MSO concert, I think it was, and I hadn't been to a concert, an orchestra concert, probably for 2 years. And we were sitting there in the stalls and the conductor walked out and the orchestra stood up. And it was all I could do not to stand up. I was so programmed. I almost jumped up in my seat to just do that thing that you do when the conductor walks out. But I thankfully don't do that. And I really like going to concerts. And hopefully, as you know, as my career picks up and as I can afford to spend as much time as possible thinking about other things other than, you know, law and what's coming up next, I can be a support to people who are either thinking about a career change or who are just interested in talking to somebody who's done that, you know, someone who's finishing up an undergraduate degree.
Mm.
And just I would really like to play a more of a supportive role in assisting young musicians in, you know, bringing concert ideas to life. I love sitting down with Matt and helping him with his programming stuff that he does, and I find that incredibly enriching.
Mm.
And as I said before, probably more so now that my self-esteem isn't riding on it.
On the outcome.
That's it.
That's amazing. Jenica, we could talk all day, and your story is absolutely fascinating. I'm so pleased to hear that you're at a place yourself where you're really keen to support others on their journey as well.
Thanks.
It's going to be a real gift for anyone who you're able to connect with in that way. So thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your story. So you can find links to anything we've mentioned in the show notes. And if you enjoyed today's podcast, then help us spread the word by sharing this with your fellow music lovers. I'm Susan DeWedger, and this has been Beyond the Stage for 3MBS. Thanks for listening. Thanks to producer Penny Manwaring Thomas. Our theme music, The Song of Us, was composed by Natasha Pearson and performed by Natasha Lynn, Alison McIntosh Deschich, and Susan DeWedger. This 3MBS podcast has been made possible by the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia and the Community Broadcasting Foundation.
This has been a 3MBS podcast. Please remember to subscribe and rate us in iTunes or your preferred podcast app.